From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Democratic National Convention hears from vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris tonight. Last night, Jill Biden made a personal appeal to voters.
Joe's purpose has always driven him forward. His strength of will is unstoppable, and his faith is unshakable. Because it's not in politicians or political parties or even in himself. It's in the providence of God. His faith is in you.
Joaquin Castro, a Democratic representative from Texas and chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, was watching. Congressman, your thoughts about the event so far and Jill Biden's comments.
I thought it was inspiring. I thought that it's been an exciting convention so far. Very different for everybody, obviously, and groundbreaking because it's all virtual rather than anybody being together in person. But I think that Jill Biden did a wonderful job at the school and conveying the idea that her husband is a man of integrity, a man of dignity, and somebody who will restore competence, most of all, to the Oval Office.
Well, but what do you think of the criticism? And there has been some. Of the lack of voices from your community, the Hispanic Latinx community. Your own brother was the only Latino presidential candidate. He wasn't asked to speak. He was very diplomatic about that. The other day on NPR, he said, well, you know, it's a shortened convention. But your thoughts, should he have spoken? Should there be more Hispanic speakers?
Well, I mean, look, I'd always love to see my brother speak. I was there. I introduced him at the 2012 convention. But I do think that it's been a shortened program. And they've put, you've seen Latino faces and Latino voices in different roles. I saw my friend Veronica Escobar of Texas yesterday, you know, endorsing Joe Biden for the Texas delegation. My friend Eva Longoria, who did a great job as master of ceremonies a few nights ago. So you've seen different Latino and Latina voices there. You know, would have been great to see maybe a few more of the key speeches by some more Latino folks. But it has been a shortened time frame. And most of all, we all have to work together with one mission, which is to defeat Donald Trump in November.
What about the issues that are particular to your community, especially there in Texas, immigration, the border?
Well, I think Joe Biden's going to be a night and day difference from Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump has used immigrants and brown immigrants in particular as his number one political punching bag. And what we've seen over the last 3.5 years or so is real cruelty. Somebody who has a guy like Stephen Miller in the White House who relishes that cruelty, unfortunately. Joe Biden's going to be obviously very different. Somebody who respects folks, regardless of their immigration status. Somebody who's going to make sure that people are treated with dignity and respect.
Well, but during the primary, Joe Biden promised a 100-day moratorium on deportations. We're not hearing that now. It's not on the platform on his website. And meanwhile, President Trump is using the language he used in his first run for president. Yesterday, he called immigrants rapists and murderers. Do you think there needs to be a stronger case for immigration reform?
Well, I think that as Joe Biden hopefully wins the presidency and as Democrats, I believe, will pick up the United States Senate, we'll have a chance to work together, all of us, in pursuing comprehensive immigration reform and hopefully early in Joe Biden's term. And so I think we're going to see a lot of positive changes and also that the human rights abuses that we've seen at the border will stop.
How do you get interest among young Latino voters? Because it appears that it's not there. In the primaries, Joe Biden lost the young Latino vote to Senator Bernie Sanders by huge margins in California, then in your state of Texas. Now a survey by Voto Latino finds a lack of enthusiasm again, for the Biden ticket. Can the Biden campaign, you know, do anything to fix that? Last night, we saw Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez nominate, it was just a symbol, but nominate Bernie Sanders for president because there were delegate votes coming in for him. That's a reminder to young Latinos that he is not the candidate and that she is one of their heroes, and then she's relegated to this sort of second-tier nomination. How do you get their enthusiasm?
No, I think Alexandria is the future. But I think that you'll see a lot of enthusiasm among Latinos, young and old, for Joe Biden. In fact, I believe that we'll see the highest Latino turnout in terms of percentage of the voting electorate come out to vote this year, including young Latinos, because as they watch what's going on with Donald Trump, They see a man who is ruining their future when they dream about their careers and what they want to do in the coming years. And so I think that people are going to be very motivated. You know, even though a lot of folks may have preferred Bernie Sanders or somebody else in the primary, they know that Joe Biden is much closer to them ideologically and in terms of what they wish for their country than Donald Trump.
Texas Democratic Representative Joaquin Castro. Congressman Castro, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Apple today became the first company in the U.S. to hit a market valuation of $2 trillion. This follows the S&P 500 closing at a record level yesterday, beating a previous record not seen since February before the pandemic became a daily part of American life. But does this gain really line up with the country's current economic reality? Joining us now from Chicago is Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton. Diane, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Well, what do you make of what's happening with the stock market right now?
Well, it does seem that the dissonance between Wall Street and Main Street is a bit deafening these days. I think the important thing to remember, as we've always said, is the stock market is not the economy, and the economy is not the stock market. And that's never been more true than it is today. In fact, in many ways, what we're seeing in the stock market, there's several issues. One is that it doesn't reflect what's going on Main Street because it really doesn't reflect the composition of the pain that Main Street has felt. But also, there is a bet out there, a sort of latent bet that massive and widespread consolidation will go to the benefit of those large companies, which undermines our dynamism, our entrepreneurship, and our ability to generate jobs on the other side of this crisis.
So what's your sense then of what's going on in the real economy or on Main Street? Because we do see unemployment still above 10%. We're seeing, you know, around a million people filing for unemployment claims each week. That's a lot historically. What's your sense of what's really happening?
Well, what we're really seeing on Main Street is that many of what people thought were just transitory or temporary employment losses are now becoming permanent employment losses. In fact, what we fear is we're starting to see a lot of plateauing in economic data, which is bad when you're still at such a low level. The inability to get out of the depth of the hole created by the pandemic, and what kinds of scars does that leave us with, and wounds for longer term. And that's what we're really worried about at this stage of the game.
The Federal Reserve has taken extraordinary steps since this pandemic to prop up a lot of parts of the economy. How much of an effect do you think the Fed is having right now on the stock market? And how much of an effect is the Fed having on everything else?
Well, there's no question that the Fed has had an impact on the stock market. And we've seen Jay Powell, who's head of the Federal Reserve, step out of his comfort zone and out of his lane and say, we need more action by Congress. The economy needs more fiscal aid. And it's not just stimulus. Stimulus is at the other side of this when we can really recover. We need aid so that if COVID is the iceberg, we won't be the Titanic to get lifeboats in the water with supplies for both small businesses and for those households that have been hit hard by this crisis through, repeatedly, Jay Powell says, no fault of their own.
But it doesn't look like there will be any more aid coming between now and the election. If they couldn't get it done just now, they probably won't do it in September or October when things are going to get really kind of crazy with politics. What do you expect if there's no more aid from Congress between now and Election Day?
I'd be shocked if they don't do some more aid from Congress. But if we have no more aid from Congress, the key issues are, of course, the 27.3 million people who are currently on unemployment insurance who just lost that supplemental check. That's at least a $15 to $18 billion blow per week to the U.S. economy. And that's to pay for basics of food and shelter. And that compounds very rapidly. It may be, we may get a vaccine in 2021, but that's an eternity for a family trying to feed themselves this week by today and tomorrow. And I think that's important. Mm-hmm. Also, the issue on states, not getting transfers to state and local governments, given the hole they've blown in their budgets. This is huge. This is the main reason the employment recovery was not more robust coming out of the Great Recession. Learn the lessons from the past and do transfers to the states. We've already mismanaged the virus. We have a chance to at least block some of these holes, but starting to feel like putting fingers in a dike, and we just can't afford that given the kind of humanitarian and economic catastrophe we're facing if we don't get some aid out there soon.
But you think that it's possible that Congress will do something in the coming months?
I do think it's possible Congress will do something. I think them coming back to deal with the post office gives them another reason to talk with each other. It's really important to understand that as much as I know the economy is not the stock market, it hasn't gotten through the message entirely to Congress. And that means you need to call your congresspeople and let them know what's really going on. I think once they return back home after seeing the devastation, that they will be more inclined to do more. We're also not getting funding for more testing, the things we need to manage the virus without more aid from Congress. That has to happen.
That is Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton. Diane, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And as we continue to cover the economic side of the pandemic, we'd love to hear from you. If you have lost your job, if you've been furloughed, if you're trying to get assistance, please let us know about it at hereandnow.org.
This year marks the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote, although black women, well, we'll get to that. The history of women's voting rights is as complicated as this country's. Yesterday, President Trump pardoned suffragist Susan B. Anthony, who was arrested for voting illegally, a pardon her devoted fans immediately rejected. They said she was proud of her arrest. Elizabeth Cady Stanton refused to extend her fight for the 19th Amendment, a vote for women, to the 15th, a vote for black men, and she made it clear when she said women, she meant white. Black women suffragists were often told to march at the back of a protest, and yet Sojourner Truth, formerly enslaved, carried her fight against slavery into suffrage with her famous Ain't I a Woman speech, and worked with both Anthony and Stanton, despite severe differences over the black right to vote. Pretty generous. Well, next week, sculptor and historian Meredith Bergman will show us what she imagines that might have looked like. She'll unveil the first ever statue of real women in New York Central Park. How can that be? There's a statue of Alice in Wonderland. But Meredith's gorgeous work, we'll have a picture at hereandnow.org, is a 14-foot-tall bronze monument of Sojourner Truth, Susan B. Anthony, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Meredith joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And also with us today, historian Susan Ware. Her new book is American Women's Suffrage, Voices from the Long Struggle for the Vote, 1776 to 1965. Susan, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
And Meredith, in 2003, you created the Boston Women's Memorial. We'll post a picture of that as well. It features Abigail Adams, Phyllis Wheatley, and Lucy Stone. But you read a lot to work on this one. What did you need to find out?
Well, when you're making a portrait of someone who is deep in history, with whom you can't talk, of whom there might not be casual photographs, you need to try to understand what they looked like when they were feeling things that were not in the photography studio, what they understood, what they were perplexed by, and you have to try to get inside their heads and their lives in order to portray them and bring them to life in sculpture.
And you picture them in your work, which is called the Women's Rights Pioneers Monument. They are either seated or standing around a table. Sojourner Truth's hands are open as if she's, what, making a point, pleading, strategizing?
I think it should be open to the visitor's interpretation. I think they are definitely strategizing, discussing. They might be arguing. I don't know what Elizabeth Cady Stanton is about to write down. Anthony is handing a document that says votes for women to Stanton, but she may have just been talking to Sojourner Truth. And Sojourner Truth and Anthony are both looking at Stanton and perhaps they're ganging up on her. I don't know. I wanted it to be a moment in the midst of a conversation.
There's also what has been described as little Easter eggs, surprises, hidden surprises. Stanton's dress has sunflower motifs.
When Stanton began to write editorials and publish them, she didn't dare use her own name because of her parents, especially her father's disapproval. She was quite young. And she signed them Sunflower. And then that flower later became an emblem of the suffrage movement.
Susan, you have devoted your life to these women. The notion that there's, what, maybe 10 statues of women across the country, maybe I'm exaggerating, but and that one of them to these women is finally going to be in such a prominent place, your thoughts?
It makes me happy and proud, and also you know, disappointed that it took the centennial of the 19th Amendment before we had a monument like this. You know, like so many other things in women's history and suffrage history, we can mark and celebrate what's been accomplished, and yet it's a reminder often of how far we still have to go.
And by the way, according to the Smithsonian American Art Museum's Art Inventories Catalog, there's only about 7% of over 5,000 public outdoor statues that are women. The rest are men. But Sojourner Truth, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony.
Well, I think the most important thing is having them all in the same frame of reference, because each in their own way was so central. You have Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who form, I think, one of the great political friendships and partnerships of all time. And Sojourner Truth comes from a different path, but also one that intersects, especially with Stanton and Anthony in the years before the Civil War, the abolition movement. And I think the power of having these three women together is that it shows the roots of women's suffrage and women's rights in the struggle to free the slaves. No better symbol of that than Sojourner Truth.
What do you imagine they're saying?
Oh, they have to be talking about strategy and who their friends are and who their enemies are, what they can do next. Is it this law in the New York State Legislature? Is it this convention that we're convening in Cincinnati? They've got so much that they want to do. In some ways, the funny thing about the monument is that they're in repose, because all three of these women were women in motion. And I see them as standing in for the hundreds, thousands of women who participated in this movement.
By the way, Susan, just very briefly, why didn't Black women benefit from the 19th Amendment that Sojourner Truth fought for?
Well, African-American women were very much part of the women's suffrage movement. You don't need to tell Black women about the importance of the vote, because they have seen it taken away from their men in the aftermath of the Civil War. But unfortunately, the 19th Amendment, when it's passed, has little bearing on where the vast majority of African Americans, male and female, live, which is in the American South. And there, the women, when they try to vote, and they do try to vote, are subject to the same Jim Crow restrictions that have been put in place to keep African American men from voting. And so it's very important, as we mark this milestone in women's history, to remember that it is an incomplete one, that it really has an asterisk with it, and that for African American women, it was the Voting Rights Act of 1965, not the 19th Amendment, that finally guaranteed their right to vote.
Mm-hmm. Meredith Bergman, back to your monument. It is so beautiful. I'm looking at different details. All their hands seem to be doing something. Your hands had to mold it in clay first before you cast it. What's that like to shape these women and then stand back?
Well, when I stand back in the middle of the working process, I'm just seeing mistakes, seeing things that need to be fixed. But it is daunting, and it is kind of awe-inspiring to make something so much larger than yourself. Anthony is the one who's standing, and she's 9 feet tall. It's quite an involved process, and I actually made the monument three times, first as a little maquette, then as a one-third height model, and then jumping up to the full size.
And in one of the original ideas that you had, Stanton and Anthony were holding a scroll on which were the names of other suffragists. You had Ida B. Wells and Anna Julia Cooper. I mean, what's the plan now? The nonprofit Monumental Women was behind this. Is the goal to get more monuments to these monumental women?
Well, Monumental Women worked for 6 years to win this site and get this monument done. And their plan is to create a women's history trail throughout New York City and to present a challenge and help and guidance to other municipalities and the rest of New York City in erecting more statues. I did want to say that the women are not exactly in repose. They are sitting on the edge of their seats. And Susan B. Anthony has just arrived. She's come in from organizing, wearing her traveling dress with her big bag full of pamphlets for debate.
They're not having tea. You know, they're not. Right. Yeah, they're not sitting back. They are, as you said, they're leaning in.
Yes.
And well, they're like vibrating.
And there is an underlying message, which is that this work is not finished. And as Susan says at the end of her wonderful book, Why They Marched, that feminism is cumulative and ongoing, and that's why they are sitting on the edges of their seats.
And why they're talking to each other and giving us a model of conversations that happened back then and need to continue happening today as we try and move things forward.
Mm. That's author and historian Susan Ware. And we've also been speaking with sculptor Meredith Bergman, whose Women's Rights Pioneers Monument showing Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Sojourner Truth will be the first monument in Central Park to honor women who were real. It'll be unveiled August 26th. We have pictures at hereandnow.org. It's really quite something.
And by the way, we are all going to be able to watch the unveiling of this live, and it's happening at 8 in the morning, which is, I'm not really a morning person, but the thought of getting up on the day of National Equality Day, the day that we're celebrating the centennial, and starting the day with the unveiling of this statue is just so profound. And we can all share this moment. Even if we can't be together physically, we are there virtually. And there is a power to that.
We'll link everybody up at hereandnow.org. We'll share that moment. And I'm certain some tears will be shed. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Robin.
You're very welcome, Robin. Thank you. Thank you for paying attention to this project.
Yes.
Again, the unveiling of the monument is next Wednesday, August 26th at 8 a.m. We'll link you with ways to watch on the Monumental Woman website and Facebook page. And again, the first statue depicting real women in Central Park and the very first to depict an African American. Work not finished indeed. When federal eviction protections expired July 24th, some cities took measures to protect renters at risk of losing their homes. Not Houston, where renters make up half the city's population. Houston Public Media's Jen Rice reports.
Cameron Mollick lost his job at an accounting firm in June during a round of COVID-19 layoffs. He supports his parents who live with him. He was still waiting for his first unemployment check. He explained this to his landlord.
She's like, I don't care. It's your responsibility. I don't care your financial crisis that you have.
If Mollick lived in Austin or Dallas, Los Angeles or Chicago, his landlord wouldn't be able to evict him yet because those cities, along with many others across the country, have enacted emergency renter protections. And in cities like New York, Seattle, and Minneapolis, renters are still protected under state moratoriums. Houston is the largest city in America where renters don't have any state or local eviction protections in place during the pandemic. When asked why last month, Mayor Sylvester Turner pointed to a COVID-19 housing task force made up of landlords, renter advocates, and local officials.
We have started a task force between the county and the city, and we'll see what comes from that.
So task force members rushed to draft an ordinance before federal protections expired, giving renters a grace period, and unanimously recommended that the mayor pass it. Here's Rick Campo, the CEO of Camden Property Trust. He co-chairs the task force.
It has all of the constituents who oftentimes don't agree. They agreed, right? Which is interesting and good.
But Turner rejected their recommendation. At a recent press conference, I asked him why.
Who is not asking for this ordinance?
Well, I have a number of stakeholders around my board, too, and there's 16 council members. And I don't think any of the council members, neither have I, obligated my responsibility.
But city council members do support a grace period, says council member and housing committee chair Tiffany Thomas.
He knows the majority of us are in support. Absolutely.
The mayor argues a grace period makes things worse for renters because rent accumulates and people end up owing more money at the end. Zoe Middleton is with the renter advocacy group Texas Housers. She wants a grace period ordinance, but she's not surprised the mayor opposes it.
It's just inconsistent with the mayor's worldview. He believes, like, very strongly markets will regulate themselves and that landlords will voluntarily enter into agreements with their tenants.
He's historically been favorable to the development community and to the business community in the city.
That's University of Houston political science professor Brandon Rodinghouse.
In this case, seems like they tend to agree that there should be some kind of rent moratorium. So I guess that's the real question is, like, you know, who is he specifically listening to when, as a larger community, they tend to back there being a moratorium?
But Rodinghouse says the mayor has almost total control over what the council can vote on, and he's kept a grace period off the agenda. But he has put in place a $15 million rent relief program, with another $20 million going out soon. That funding goes to landlords, not renters. Housing advocate Zoe Middleton says the rent relief is great, but it's not either or. Renters need a grace period too. Cameron Malik, the renter facing eviction, is now moving out while taking care of his parents and trying to find a new job.
I'm very anxious. I don't know what to do.
He said the stress was so bad he even went to the ER recently with a severe headache. His eviction case is scheduled for the end of August, and he decided to move to Dallas. For Here and Now, I'm Jen Rice.
There have been worries about the damaging effects of kids spending too much time looking at screens for years now, but during the pandemic, with school and socializing moving entirely online or almost entirely, limiting screen time has become almost impossible. So should we be concerned? Joining us now is Michael Robb, who is Senior Director of Research at Common Sense Media. Michael, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, and about how much time on average did kids spend online or looking at their screens before the pandemic, and how has that changed since the pandemic?
For young children between the ages of 0 to 8, kids spend about 2 to 2.5 hours a day with screen media. Kids between the ages of 8 to 18 spend somewhere around 7.5 hours a day with screen media pre-COVID. And right now, we don't know. Our best guess is that it's probably a lot more than that because we are so much more reliant on technology than we were pre-pandemic. But the honest answer is I don't know exactly how much now.
Well, if we are, in fact, looking at kids spending a lot more time looking at their screens now than they did before, does that concern you?
It depends. I mean, I think in some ways we should be looking to technology and media to be more of a safety net than we've considered it in the past. And I think we probably need to move away from thinking about screen time as some kind of monolithic thing that's going to affect all kids equally and shift from thinking about quantity to thinking more about quality of screen use.
What does that mean? What would be high quality screen use?
You know, if you have a kid who's engaged with high quality content that's stoking their curiosity and it's fueling their imagination, you know, who's to say that it should end just because it hit some kind of arbitrary screen limit? And what we know from research is that it's very little to do with just how much time and a lot more to do with the quality of the content that they see, whether it's something that's educational, that it's well matched to a kid's interests, and also what's the environment around that media experience. So if parents are, you know, either watching or using media with their kids or maybe asking them about what they're seeing and hearing after the fact, all that's going to make a much bigger impact on the quality of that media experience than just knowing how much time the kid's spending with it.
But if, in fact, kids are just spending more time playing video games or watching entertainment content, that would be a problem.
I think a better way to look at this might be to kind of back into it from the other direction. You know, we have maybe 10, 15 years worth of research about, you know, iPads and interactive media and things like that. But we have 100 years of research about child development. So if you know during this moment where kids are more socially isolated and maybe more prone to having kind of disrupted schedules than they have in the past, that you know that they are still engaging in the things that we know are healthy for kids, that they're sleeping enough, getting some exercise, that they are being social online or off, engaging in, you know, their hobbies, then you don't have to worry about counting every single screen minute.
Still, there are certainly concerns about mental health for, yeah, you know, especially if teenagers are using a lot of social media or kids are using more social media. Tell us about some of those concerns that exist right now.
Yeah. So, you know, we've observed in recent years that there has been an increase in depression and suicidal ideation and suicide among adolescents, particularly among young girls between the ages of 10 to 14 and girls of color. And this was all occurring pre-pandemic. A lot of people think that social media or technology use is a cause of that increase. But when we look at the research, what you find is that that claim is pretty uncertain. But we do find, though, is that there are some kids who are especially vulnerable. And those are the kids that we should be more concerned about.
Well, in a recent study by your group, Common Sense Media, found that the conflict that screen time creates oftentimes in families can be damaging to mental health rather than the actual screen time.
Yeah, when you look at the actual like size of an effect, that conflict within families, including conflict over screen time, can be a bigger driver of mental health problems than actual, you know, just looking at how much screen time a kid had. You know, I don't want to say that that should just mean it's a free-for-all for all kids on social media or online. But, you know, it is the case that kids who are having offline problems are more likely to also be having online problems. You know, if you have a kid who has kind of like a low social status offline or a history of being victimized or cyber or bullied, you know, those are kids who have really unique vulnerabilities when they go online and may need extra care and support on social media.
So what are your recommendations to parents who are listening to this who may wonder how much time their child should be allowed to spend looking at a screen each day and how to make sure that they're getting the high quality screen time as opposed to low quality screen time?
This is a very stressful time for a lot of people, and I'm advising parents to really not feel guilty, right? We are living through a massive cultural shock and families have enough stress to deal with. Counting screen minutes should be pretty low on the list of concerns for any of us. I think parents should remember that not all screens are equal. Just because a kid has online learning and you think that's adding to their screen time, don't worry about that. Like, we shouldn't be lumping all screen activities together as if they're all the same thing. Like you just alluded to, I think good content is key. And the other thing I would say is try to use technology to bond, right? Because one of the things that we really know about child development is that relationships are critical. And given that, you know, we are probably going to be using more technology for the foreseeable future, we should be using that tech to help kids connect to friends and family, to collaborate with each other, to play together, to share stories, to chat and stay in contact with each other, because those relationships are going to be helping to build kids' resilience and support their positive mental health outcomes.
Now, I know that even as an adult, I should not be looking at a screen right before I go to sleep, even though often I do, but I shouldn't be doing it because it can make my sleep not as good as it would otherwise be. Does that apply? Should parents keep their kids off the screens right before bed?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I have the same concern. So one of the things that we find is that the link between good quality sleep and positive mental health outcomes is much stronger, for example, than the link between screen use and positive mental health outcomes. So getting a good night's sleep is really, really important. So to the extent that, you know, if you have a kid who's on really late at night or they have notifications that are waking them up and keeping them awake at night, then that is an issue that should be addressed.
There's also the issue of access. There are people in this country who don't have the same access to technology as others. With kids especially spending more time looking at screens, is there going to be a digital divide problem that gets exacerbated because of that?
Absolutely. And this is one of my primary concerns. Digital media technology should be a social safety net right now. And you can't really understand kids' experiences and mental health or their digital technology use without considering poverty, because poverty is shaping both of those things. And COVID-19 has really shown a bright light on the existing inequalities that are placing too many young people at risk of being left behind. So, you know, what you end up with is you have a lot of vulnerable adolescents, specifically those who are Black, Latinx, or from lower income households, who are unable to reliably access or receive support in digital spaces. And we can't ignore the fact that those inequalities are likely to be amplified online and during this crisis.
Do you think that this whole experience is going to lead to long-term changes in how we think about kids and screen time? Because I think, you know, going into this conversation even, I was thinking the less screen time, probably the better for kids. But it sounds like you're saying we're moving in a different direction.
I mean, I think the issue is that we are so obsessed with screen time that we kind of miss the point sometimes. It is what you do on screens that matters. So I hope that one of the things that comes out of this is that, you know, we come to have a better, more nuanced understanding of the relationship that technology and media play in our lives. And by way of example, you know, I used to hear a lot of concern from parents about their, mostly boys, being addicted to Fortnite and it being a really serious disruption. And since the pandemic has started, I've heard a lot of gratitude from parents whose kids can't be social with each other in person. So thankful that their kids are able to play Fortnite together and talk to each other and have fun together. It kind of just shows you, you know, how quickly one thing can flip 180 degrees, depending on your perspective. None of this should replace in-person interaction. When a vaccine comes out and people are able to go back outside, we should absolutely still be emphasizing the importance of being together in person. But I do hope that we think a little more clearly about what the real dangers are as it comes up with screen use and social media use.
That is Michael Robb, who's Senior Director of Research at Common Sense Media. We'll link you to their study about this at hereandnow.org. Michael, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And as we just heard, Fortnite is one of the most popular video games in the world, a battle royale concept we've talked about before. Kids are playing it together remotely during the pandemic. But if you want to download Fortnite on your iPhone or Android, you won't be able to find it. That's because both Apple and Google booted Epic Games, maker of Fortnite, from their app stores last week after Epic launched a way for users to make in-game purchases directly through them and for less money, rather than through Apple or Google, which normally take a 30% cut. Well, now Epic Games is suing Apple and Google in what's shaping up to be a closely watched antitrust case. Tim Sweeney, founder of Epic Games, told Bloomberg News recently he's fighting monopoly behavior.
Apple says if you build an app for our platform, first of all, you can only distribute it through their store. They don't allow competing stores. Like, imagine a town that only allowed Target. That's totally un-American and uncompetitive.
And he's not alone. Other companies like Netflix and Spotify and smaller developers say a 30% cut is too high. Let's bring in Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. So, Ben, in response, Apple says the price they charge is not just fair, but also safe.
Yeah, so this is kind of one of the biggest arguments that Apple makes, and I think Google makes it as well, although less so. There's a lot of really malicious software out there, and as an Apple user, Apple would argue you're safe from a lot of it because Apple controls and curates its software marketplace. Giving the customer a better experience is a cost, right? So Apple is offsetting that cost by taking its cut. But it's also true that big picture, Apple is in this very long process, Robin, of moving its areas of profit away from hardware and into services. And this represents a bit of that plan for Apple, too, making some profit or at least revenue in this area.
Okay, well, Tim Sweeney, he's described as an iconoclast. He still runs Epic Games out of Cary, North Carolina. He has not moved to Silicon Valley. Talk more about his motivations here.
So I think Sweeney has cast himself as a pretty unique guy, and that bears out in reality that Fortnite, Epic's biggest property, is a unique game. You know, in fact, Sweeney has argued recently that Fortnite is really more than a game. It's kind of a digital space that can be shared by millions of people at the same time. It's hosted live concert events for millions of players all watching at the same time in this environment that they can kind of jump around in and interact in. And around this specific battle, the game has literally put up billboards inside of Fortnite telling players to, quote, join the fight against Apple, which is very kind of Fortnite style. Someone recently tweeted that no matter who you are, Fortnite is better at the internet than you. And Sweeney's company has at times proven that out. I think, you know, it's also important to note here, right? Epic is not a small game company. Epic makes a lot of money and they want to make more money. And one way of doing that is having a real direct link to the customer and being able to charge the customer whatever it wants for its services and not have a cut taken out by Apple or Google.
No, it's Fortnite's world and we just live in it. Well, but Fortnite is partially owned by the Chinese mega company Tencent. They have a 40% stake in Epic Games. So what's going on here? Are they also using Fortnite to put pressure on Apple and Google, who they will see as American competitors?
I mean, yeah, sure. But I don't know that this fight should be viewed necessarily as a kind of Chinese Trojan attack on Apple and Google's competitive advantage in the world. The issues being fought out here are, in a sense, really bigger than any one company or country. It's this, you know, question of who gets to control the marketplace and whether or not that benefits the consumer and that sort of thing. So I think there are valid arguments on both sides. But I do think that we are at a bit of a tipping point here in the conversation about anti-competitive behavior among big tech companies. And, you know, Fortnite and Epic are spoiling for a fight, and it looks like they're going to get it.
And maybe they can afford it. Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Ben, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, one last thought on the DNC. Kamala Harris and Barack Obama headline night three of the Democratic National Convention tonight. But even the VP candidate and former president might have a tough time outshining last night's breakout star. I'm referring, of course, to the plate of calamari. All right, kidding, of course, but the pile of fried squid held by a strong, silent, masked man who turned out to be a top local chef stole the show when Joseph M. McNamara, Rhode Island's Democratic Party chair, posed beside the platter as he cast his state's vote.
The calamari comeback state of Rhode Island casts one vote for Bernie Sanders and 34 votes for the next president, Joe Biden.
Viewers were delighted. Stephen Stashwick of Chicago tweeted, Rhode Island's use of its DNC state roll call primarily as an opportunity to hawk calamari is the most on-brand of all the states and territories. Indeed, McNamara has been on a mission for years to make calamari to Rhode Island what oranges are to Florida or lobsters to Maine. Every state boasted of something last night, but this was as if we'd cut to an infomercial.
And our state appetizer, calamari, is available in all 50 states.
Available in all 50 states. But the Washington Post reminds us his fight to make it the state appetizer was one of the most contentious in state legislature history. Do not get the Rhode Island quahog people started. A quahog, Jeremy, as you know, is a big fat clam.
As Here everyone now, who watches The Family Guy knows, yes, indeed.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here Now.